Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Look at all you people who are here in the Zendo on a holiday weekend and out there in the Zoom realm. It's lovely to see you all on this pretty nice weekend. Not just a little haze, not too much smoke. I hope you're getting outdoors. Well, last week, who was here for last week's talk? Yeah, quite a few of you. I gave a talk about leaving home and returning home, and how we tend to do that in cycles, you know. For some of us, there's many different leave takings in the course of a life and returnings. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our school of Zen in Japan, said, "Why leave behind the seat that exists in your home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands?" And yet he himself traveled to China to find his true teacher. So sometimes we do travel to distant lands. We go off to meditation retreats. We go on foot, by bicycle, by kayak. I've just been hearing about some of people's trips over the summer. Into wild places, near and far. And then we come home again and again, changed. Sometimes we return to our origins, our home place, or people we knew long ago, and realize that they have changed and we have changed. We are always in relationship, changing and being changed. But these home leavings and returns can bring that into our awareness more vividly. My returns to my homeland, the eastern United States, have been more frequent over the last decade as my parents became more and more frail and unable to make their yearly trip out here to visit. So I was tending to go in the spring and in the fall, the best seasons out there. And among those trips was one in 2019 to my 50th high school reunion. I had not been to any previous high school reunions. High school was a time I did not particularly wish to revisit. Or hold with much nostalgia. And I'd only stayed in touch with one friend all these years later. But somehow I felt it was now or never. I was curious. And maybe it was part of this sort of process of life review and integration that I have come to, and maybe many of us come to when we reach the later part of our own lifespan. So I reconnected with a group of friends, women, all women, who I would characterize loosely as the smart girls. And to my shame and chagrin, I was known as the smartest. This is not an asset. We weren't exactly nerds or geeks. We weren't exactly a clique. We were varied in our interests, and most of us were involved in a number of extracurricular activities. We were pretty good citizens. But we were the kind of girls boys in our own class did not date. We had to go elsewhere. We were too smart for our own good, as the saying goes. But even in that group, I had always felt like something of a loner. I got along well and was cordial with a great variety of my classmates in all strata and varieties. But with each year of high school, I became more unhappy, more disaffected with the world around me, more despairing of finding my own place in that world. And there was no one I confided in. no one. So what came as a surprise to me then, as we women greeted each other after 50 years later, was the genuine warmth we felt and expressed, and the openness with which we shared our reflections on our high school years. How we each had suffered in our teenage angst in ways that we hadn't let on at the time. There had been parental breakups, one who had been the new girl in a very different social milieu, and most illuminating was the one I'd known the longest, the wealthy girl I'd been the acceptable playmate for in our early years, until we were transferred in grade 4 to a regional school where there was a more upper middle class demographic, and she left me in the dust. The one who always showed up in September with clothes from Saks Fifth Avenue and was chosen by the AFS, American Field Service, to spend a summer in Japan. She revealed that it had been her very privilege that set her apart, isolated her, and the feeling that she was not quite as smart or as high achieving as the rest of us. Who knew? Who knew? All of them had gone immediately to university grad school, some to PhDs, and all to professional work, where I had burned my college applications in lieu of a draft card and gone off to Canada with my older first real boyfriend. I'd had 30 jobs by the time I was 30. That's counting everything. Some very small ones. And after that, done freelance translating and taught ESL before becoming a clinical counselor working primarily in hospice palliative care, and I'd become a Zen priest. Who'd have ever predicted that? And finally, I was able to stand my ground with these women and be myself without shame or embarrassment. Life had buffeted us all enough to put us on even ground. Maybe if the pandemic hadn't come along, we'd have become absorbed in our separate lives again. But through the magic of Zoom, we'd stayed in touch through monthly meetings. We shared our fears, loneliness, concerns about political, societal, and environmental issues, deaths of parents, illnesses of spouses and other family members, and also our love of film, books, music, gardening, and nature. It's kind of a miracle, really. Something similar happened with another group of women I'd known in my early 20s in our back to the land hippie days in New Brunswick in the Maritimes. Another kind of 50-year reunion had been planned for 2021, but most were still not confident traveling under ongoing pandemic conditions, so we finally gathered a year ago. Would have been a year ago right now. And there's more than I can tell here about that. Well, maybe I will tell one little story. But again, we'd been meeting on Zoom with a kind of leveling of differences leading up to this gathering last year, sharing our hardships and joys. And again, I no longer felt like the black sheep, the one who'd strayed from the flock by leaving. Others had left too, later. We had all changed and been changed by life. And yes, I was still different. But the differentness didn't have to be hidden. Maybe it could even be a gift to offer. And the one little story I will tell about that is that one woman who was a friend whose little 3-year-old daughter had been killed in a freak accident. And really it was a life-changing event for me because I realized when we all got together, they were, some of you have heard me tell this story before. The people at whose house the accident occurred kind of sent our friends off to Vermont, where they'd come from. We didn't even see them for 6 months. We couldn't grieve with them. And then they came back to their beautiful little homestead, hand-built house, sugar maple grove, beautiful garden. And we gathered and spread Josie's ashes under this big, big sugar maple tree and came back to the little house and had a potluck, because that's all we knew how to do. We didn't have any prayers. We didn't have any elders to help us. We didn't have any songs to sing. We had no, even though we could grow all our vegetables and we could make quilts and chop wood and do all those things, we did not know how to hold this event, and we lost our friends, and they never came back. And she was one of the women that I reconnected to in this these meetings prior to the reunion. And so that when the day after we arrived, she said, "Tomorrow is the anniversary of Josie's death. Can we do something?" And we went to the beach along the Bay of Fundy, and we all gathered pebbles and we made a stupa. We didn't call it like a cairn. And we decorated it with shells, and we told a few little stories. It wasn't very formal, but we were grown up enough to be able to do that with each other finally. 50 years later, or not quite. As I came to the end of preparing my talk last week, I realized I wasn't going to have time to share two more passages from my teacher Norman Fisher's book, Sailing Home, which uses Homer's epic poem, The Odyssey, as a metaphor for our journey through life. As it says in the subtitle, Navigating Life's Perils and Pitfalls, Distractions and Temptations Along the Way. And then I received an email from a Sangha member commenting on my talk and asking how I had changed over the years between home leaving and home returning. And the two passages that I left out last week offer keys to the answer, so I thought I have to do part two of this talk. Last week, for those of you who weren't here, I talked about this home leaving, home returning, and two stories about returning to the Baptist church I grew up in and left when I was in early adolescence. So the first passage in the book that I want to share with you is about meeting disasters on our journeys, because we do, right? We just never know what's around the bend. There's so many kinds of disasters. The biggest, the ones that we most often perceive, often involve death. Right? And there are so many kinds of death. Sudden, gradual, accidental, deliberate. There's murder, war, suicide. Ever since we humans became aware of death, you know, in our early primate days, it looms as like the biggest disaster. It's the scariest thing, right? How can it be? How can that be? And then there are the disasters we call natural, when the elements go wild, the earth, water, fire, and air disasters. And there are all kinds of physical illnesses and impairments and mental, emotional conditions. And then there are all the terrible things we humans do to each other. There's a lot of disasters. And we can't necessarily prevent them. Oh, I forgot to mention the minor disasters, right? As if the big ones weren't enough. We get a parking ticket. We lose our wallet or our phone. And in that event, it feels like a disaster, right? We make a disaster of those smaller ones. And it's true, we can't necessarily prevent them. Some are preventable, to a degree, but most aren't. But it does make a difference how we meet them and how we go forward, how we recover from them. So I'm going to read what Norman says in his book, and I'll just comment a little as I go. He says, we've been trained to avoid disasters, to believe that if we were really good, really smart, really energetic, really mindful, disasters would not occur, and that therefore, when they do, it must be because there's something wrong with us. Have you ever noticed that inclination of mind? What have I done wrong? What have I done wrong? Or we externalize it. He, you know, they did something wrong to me. You know, we can internalize or externalize it. I'm going to argue with him a little here, okay? It's important to be able to argue with your teacher. Not too much, but so he says, disasters can't be avoided. Well, yes, some can, but then, in hindsight, we don't call them disasters, right? If we manage to avoid them, then they're not disasters. Or they happen to somebody else, but not me. Phew. But when they are disasters, we name them disasters, this is a disaster, then it's true. It couldn't have been avoided, or it wouldn't have happened. It's happened, right? So I think he means that. And he says, as I just did, you know, sometimes they are due to some fault or miscalculation on our part, or someone else's intentional or unintentional action. And then he says, and sometimes disaster just happens with no rhyme or reason to it. I will counter that by saying there are causes and conditions to what happens, but they aren't all with reference to us, right? They're not all with reference to what we want. And so we say, well, there's no rhyme. This doesn't, you know, why did this happen? There's no rhyme or reason to it. Why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? That's the other big existential question for human beings, isn't it? There are causes and conditions, but they are much more complex and vast than we can see a lot of the time. And then he says, the disasters that befall us are the disasters we need in order to advance the plot of the story we are living. Well, I had to argue with that too, because it sounds a little bit too much like God doesn't give us more than we can handle. Some people do get more than they can handle in life. Some people do go under. Some life stories are tragic and heartbreaking. Some are heroic, and most are both. And most involve more ordinary courage than is ever recognized. So it's not a matter of, you know, that we need disasters, but that they are part of life and we have no choice but to meet them and how. He continues, but when disaster does strike, we feel devastated, ashamed, chagrined. This should never have happened, we say. And when we recover from our shock and dismay, we do as we've been trained to do, pick ourselves up and try to restore things to the state they were in before the disaster struck, with new provisions and declarations for safety and security to ensure that such things will never again happen in the future. We try to make the disaster disappear as quickly as possible, even if that requires us to ignore as much of it as is feasible, so that we can, air quotes, get on with our lives. as if this unfortunate and altogether unacceptable interlude had never happened. When the disaster is so powerful that we can't simply take it in stride, when it's so glaring that we're forced to remember and take it into account in our subsequent living, then we can fall back on a set of tried and true scenarios that will explain it away, making us sound like noble victims who have suffered and overcome, or contrite penitents who have learned their lesson. Usually, however, these scenarios are not true, but rather false tales piled on top of false tales. Although we think that happiness is the avoidance of disaster, in fact, to be happy, we need to recognize and even appreciate disaster. To be happy in a meaningful way is to know how to face disaster and how to integrate it into our lives. To do this, we must be able to feel the full force of disaster and be able to digest it without being so profoundly scarred by it that our living from then on is distorted. For none of us will ever advance beyond all disaster. You know, we live in this phenomenal world in human bodies. No matter where we are in life, disaster is always possible. This ought to make us humble and at bottom, quiet and ready for the next turn of the narrative, whatever it may be. So that's Norman's words. And he's right that there are disasters in our lives that we clearly cannot make things go back to the way they were or pretend that it never happened. Certain deaths are like that. For me, it was my sister's death in 1990 when she was only 35. That's another big story, but the complex circumstances of her illness and death and subsequent family dynamics were utterly life-altering. I would say that that experience has shaped the course of my life in many ways, including my Zen practice becoming not only central, but essential, absolutely essential to my life. It's become an ongoing inquiry for me to observe how individuals and families and human groups meet disaster and life in the aftermath. Some heal and thrive, not without difficulty. Some are permanently damaged, and it doesn't seem to depend on the event itself. So what makes a difference? I think one seed of my inquiry was sown early in life, before I was even born, in my mother's loss of both her parents in early adolescence. So as a child, I would observe my mom and her sisters and their troubles getting along with each other. You know, the way children observe the adult world and go, what's going on here? What's wrong with this picture? You know, why isn't my mom happy? Why can't she get along with her sisters? Those five kids were sent, as I said, I think I mentioned last week, to live with different aunts and uncles. The family was broken up. And that aftermath carried on throughout their adult lives. And as children, of course, we have a self-referenced view and we wonder, what do I need to do to fix this, right? How can I fix my mom so she can love me the way I need? That's how children think, right? But we catch ourselves thinking that way as adults as well. You know, that self, if I try harder, if I fight back, how can I make this better, right? Some children do strive harder, some do fight back, and some give up. And then when I was young, in my early 20s, there were two couples, the woman I just mentioned and another couple, who both experienced the death of a child, one to the sudden accident that I just mentioned and the other to a 5-year course of leukemia. And this was made a very deep impression on me, these two losses, because I love both those kids, and I was witness to the aftermath for each one. Couple survived as a couple, one didn't. What made the difference? There have been many studies done on what factors contribute to resilience in those who faced great hardship or adversity. Here are just a few. The capacity to hold paradox and complexity, not to make it black and white or right and wrong, good and bad. Positive childhood influences, even when there has been abuse and hardship, sometimes even a very small positive influence tips that balance. Some person who saw that child clearly for who they were. Intelligence, a sense of humor, moral and ethical sensibility, spiritual strength, those are all factors that have been observed, you know, in resilience studies. Our life experiences do break our hearts. And if conditions are supportive, our hearts break open without destroying us, so that we have the capacity to meet the pain of others and not turn away. So that we grow in our capacity, not just for empathy, but compassion. And not just for those we deem deserving, but for those who are lost in greed, enmity, and confusion, those who do great harm. So last week, I told those two stories about going to church, going back to church. But even then, when I left the church of my childhood back then, it wasn't an unequivocal rejection on my part, so much as a need for a wider field, a recognition that there was not a place for me there. When I first raised the question with my teacher, Norman, about receiving the Bodhisattva precepts, the Jukai ceremony, I said, "You know, Norman, this is not the first time for me to choose to live a conscious, ethical life. The first was in choosing to be baptized when I was 12 and taking the preparatory class, which consisted of all adults except me and Dougie Cromwell, the undertaker's son." Okay, here's a sidebar. Dougie Cromwell was at that 50th university. Big, big guy. And he gave me this big, big hug. Like, we knew who each other was right away. I hadn't seen this guy since, you know, ever. And, you know, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" He said, "I'm just a school janitor. I'm nobody." I said, "Dougie, I'll bet you are just the nicest, kindest school janitor ever. And that makes a difference." And he said, "Yeah, I think so." So the emphasis in that class was less on getting into heaven and avoiding hell than on living a Christ-like life in the world. So it was kind of like taking Bodhisattva vows. But throughout my various leave-takings, family, church, country, first marriage, community of my young adulthood, I think I kind of managed to maintain the mindset that I was the exile, the one who didn't fit in, the unacceptable. So I have to say that it has been my Buddhist practice that has given me the great gift of reconciliation with humanity, my own and others, with the human condition. We could call it a kind of forgiveness that is both specific and all-inclusive. I think as we come to full maturity, we have to face and come to terms with the most terrible human cruelty and injustice in this world without losing sight of or denying the human capacity for love, generosity, creativity, and compassion and wisdom, and the compassion and wisdom that our practice opens us to. we then open to forgiveness of ourselves and others and of humanity. So that's the other passage I wanted to share from Norman's book. His passage on forgiveness. It says, "The practice of forgiveness is deep and necessary. We must come to terms with it now, at this crucial threshold moment. We think of forgiveness as a part of the social sphere, which is true, but forgiveness is also a basic spiritual practice with ever-deepening dimensions. If you practice meditation or prayer regularly, you know that it is sometimes not so peaceful or so comforting. In the openness of heart that true meditation or prayer fosters, sometimes our resentful or calloused heart comes directly into view and we can't deny it. The pain in our hearts can arise in relation to a hurt we've suffered at the hands of another, but it can also come when we have caused others or ourselves pain for which we need to forgive ourselves. We are all imperfect. This is our nature. Even though we are limited creatures in a limited world, we have an unlimited capacity to imagine goodness as well as to judge and criticize. And we inherently bear resentment. Let's skip that part. We do battle. Sorry, I'm skipping. So regardless of how good or bad any of us may be, we all must forgive ourselves simply for being who and what we are. In the end, we all require deep forgiveness. If we can get to the level of experiencing the pain of having been hurt, or of having hurt another, which is really the same thing. Victim and oppressor are always locked in the embrace of pain. Then forgiving follows naturally because you see that we are all in this together. Knowing this, we can forgive another person, we can forgive ourselves, we can forgive the world, we can forgive God. Norman, being deeply steeped both in his Jewish heritage and Zen, doesn't hold back from using the word God. And some people struggle with him doing that. So I leave it to you to make what you will of that. I've come to have a kind of working definition of forgiveness in my own practice. To look and feel deeply into the causes and conditions of suffering, mine, another's, human suffering, knowing they are, those causes and conditions are far beyond my knowing, my full knowing. Looking deeply with an open mind and loving heart, releasing blame, grievance, resentment, and anger just as much as the heart is able to each time suffering arises. Repeating that verse that we will shortly begin every time we're going to chant the Bodhisattva precepts, which we do on the full moon, even though we missed the full moon on Wednesday, which was, as you probably know, a blue moon. I hope you enjoyed seeing it. We chant the precepts, and always at the beginning we chant, "All my ancient twisted karma," I kind of like "all my ancient hurtful karma, painful karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow," so I see as much and as clearly as I possibly can and acknowledge, right? And then we renew our vows. We renew our Bodhisattva vows. And we need to do that over and over and over and over again as long as we live. I think that's the answer to that question of what changed me, what changed in me, so that I can meet and be open to the changes in others. In those places, people, institutions I left behind believing they'd rejected me. Please don't think I've reached some kind of ultimate reconciliation with all that's painful in this world or in my life. I have not. And I don't think that's possible because we live in this world. We live in a painful world. And so it's an ongoing practice. There's not an end. That's what the Bodhisattva vow is. But I do, and I am so grateful that I do, have a practice that gives me a way to live in this world. And in my life, in all its complexity and paradox. There are times we get stuck in ruts in our life, habit patterns, the routines and expectations of our daily lives, our responsibilities to work and family. We find ourselves spinning our wheels in states of resentment, procrastination, boredom, irritation, competitive envy, frustration, complaint. We all know some of these. We look at our lives and all we see are our dissatisfactions. And so we decide we need to shake ourselves out of our rut and go on a pilgrimage. Yeah. Right. And then, on the other hand, sometimes we get stuck in a rut of restlessness, unable to stay put in one place for long and develop deep connections to our environment, geographical, biological, social. Unable to turn our gaze to the close by through the turning of the seasons, to stay put through the turning of the seasons, both metaphorical and literal. Always wanting the stimulation of new vistas, perhaps avoiding the creeping aversion we feel towards the familiar and the ordinary. And these are times it's really important to stay in our place, upright and awake, patiently attentive to what arises and passes away within and around us. Even the Buddha, with his first Sangha, though they wandered much of the year, came to rest in one place during the rainy season and practiced meditation more intensively, giving rise to the tradition that we follow to this day of having practice period, which we will do soon in the fall. We can stop running around and just up our practice a little. When it comes to home leaving and home staying, we can walk the middle path, not making an extreme of either one. And after a while, we come to feel that the leaving and the coming home are not so very different after all. In the flow of life and death, coming and going, arising and passing away. Sometimes we have to move into new territory, learn new ways of seeing and being. Sometimes we have to return to our origins and see with fresh eyes. Either way, we are likely to meet with disaster along the way. And then we have to learn how to forgive humanity, how to forgive life and death, how to forgive the world for being the way it is. Dogen Zenji said, the way is basically perfect and all-pervading. It is never apart from one right where one is. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? Well, even when we do go off here and there, ultimately we are always returning to our true home. As our opening verse says, may we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. So, let's chant together. Thank you everyone for listening this morning. Let's chant together and then we'll move into the Bodhisattva precept ceremony. Thank you. May